Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Absolutely. If Texas can provide weather to us, that's better than Washington with less snow and ice. I will move there for the month.
Between the Clean Fuels Conference and Commodity Classic in Texas, Kurt Kovarik with the Clean Fuels Alliance America.
You're exactly right. We've got our Clean Fuels Conference, which we hold annually. We'll be in Fort Worth at the Omni starting Monday, February 5th through the February 8th. We generally have about 1,000 attendees representing soy farmers, clean fuel producers, major fleets. Pepsi will be there. And I think we're going to have a lot of new audiences from the shipping, the rail, and the airline industry. So that's a great opportunity to engage with us as an industry. We have a great content with main stage panels and breakout sessions talking about a lot of these topics.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
In August of 2022, Congress passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which included a whole host of new clean energy policies meant to reduce carbon, address climate change, etc.
Kurt Kovarik is Vice President, Federal Affairs with Clean Fuels Alliance America.
One of those was a new tax incentive for the production and use of sustainable aviation fuel. And again, enacted in August of 2022, this tax incentive was available for 2023 and 2024. IRS has yet to basically put out the guidance on how to claim this credit. And you hit on a very important point of it. This is the first time, in my knowledge, that IRS has been tasked to implement a tax incentive based on carbon intensity. So Congress said, we're going to provide this tax incentive, and if you can prove that your fuel is a certain percentage less carbon emitting than petroleum jet fuel, you get this value of a credit, and that credit goes up based on how much cleaner you are compared to petroleum. The complicating factor here is we have some environmentalists and others who are pursuing a carbon model to score the fuels that's based on outdated data. It's a UN model that, in our view, arbitrarily penalizes crop-based biofuels. And what we're advocating for is the use of a model, as you said, called the GREET model, put together by the Argonne National Laboratory, a Department of Energy laboratory that sits just outside of Chicago, Illinois, that we view is the gold standard for calculating all of the direct emissions and the indirect emissions from biofuels. So we have folks coming to Washington tomorrow, starting tonight, for about 60 meetings on the Hill and about a half a dozen or so with the administration, not trying to necessarily put our finger on the scale of the science, but just to advocate for the use of science. You know, our problem arises when the models are manipulated in one fashion or another to try to tip the scales to arbitrarily penalize crop-based biofuels. And Tony, imagine if Congress were to create and IRS were to implement a tax incentive that uses a European UN-based model that disqualifies our own American farmers and their feedstock from qualifying for this tax incentive. It's a perverse scenario that only the most extreme environmentalists could pursue. That's our message to the administration and to Congress this week. They've got a deadline of March 1st to update the modeling and convey to sustainable aviation fuel producers how this credit's going to work. Our message is, as long as it's based on sound science that we all agree on, the U.S. government, Argonne National Laboratory model, then we don't take any issue with this. And we would hope that they don't manipulate this in a manner to penalize arbitrarily based on so-called indirect land use changes of crop-based biofuels to the point that U.S. Farmers can't even qualify.
Clean Fuels Conference will be in Fort Worth in early February, and then the group back in Houston at the end of the month.
We'll be in Houston for Commodity Classic at the very end of February. On Thursday, the 29th, Clean Fuels will be hosting a learning session to talk directly to farmers about the value that our industry, the biomass-based diesel industry, has brought to the soybean farmer, and to talk about new opportunities in winter annual crops that could be better for sustainability, as well as oil producing that we could use as an additional feedstock. So two great opportunities to engage with us and our industry in Fort Worth and then again at the Commodity Classic in Houston.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Globalization and the trading system have managed to make rich countries to increase income by GDP by 50% over that period of time.
Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala is the Director General of the World Trade Organization.
So that's rich countries. Of course, for poor countries and emerging markets, 150% from a lower base. So it's not, and the Peterson Institute work also shows that the U.S. has benefited from the international trading system since the Second World War by up to about $2.3 trillion. So, you know, there are so many studies that have been done that have demonstrated how the trading system has helped not only poor countries but rich countries. So it's reasserting and reminding people of that, that I think is the surprise that we have to say yes. But is there a no part? I'm not surprised, because the globalization has also had its discontents. And people should remember Joe Stiglitz's work way back, which was a bestseller. At that time, you know, there were many who didn't really listen. But it's true, there have been sides of globalization that have not worked for everybody. There were poor people in rich countries who were left behind, and there were poor countries who were left out of the system. So the issue is, does that then mean you throw out globalization? No. It means that we look and ask the question, how do we take care of those who have been marginalized within the system? But trade, as you said, you need someone to blame and to knock. And even where technology is the culprit for taking away jobs, trade is often blamed. Yeah. And that's where the problem lies.
And though globalization has been fairly popular, she also adds,
you know, the work we've done shows that trade has been pretty resilient. We are, if you look at the figures for global trade, it's at an all-time high of about $30.5 trillion, $25 trillion in goods trade, the rest in services. So it's at an all-time high. And if you look at numbers of trade between the U.S. and China, for instance, or China and EU, they are also at all-time highs. For 2022, that's the latest. We have full figures. You know, the U.S. Commerce Department released $691 billion of trade between U.S. and China. For the EU, it's even more. It's slightly over $900 billion worth of trade. So right now, in aggregate, the data we have doesn't quite substantiate the loud noise you hear. But does that mean that they are not issues? They are. We see emerging fragmentation in trade. And that's why we sounded a warning almost starting a year ago that we're beginning to see signs of fragmentation. And that could be very costly to the world, including and especially so to developing countries and emerging markets. So some of the work we did just trying to see, suppose the world fragments into two trading blocks. What does it mean? And we did some simulations, you know, using UN voting patterns to simulate the two trading blocks. And we found that, you know, the world would lose in about 5% of GDP in the longer term. That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's like the economy of losing Japan's economy to the world. And for emerging markets and developing countries, the numbers would be in the double digits, like 11 to 12%. So they would lose the most from fragmentation of world trade into blocks.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
This is a big case involving a non-ag company, Hyatt Hotels Corporation.
Roger McCowan is a tax law specialist with Washburn University.
But many companies, including agribusinesses and retailers, they utilize these customer loyalty programs as a means of keeping and attracting customers. And we deal with this just about on a daily basis. There's so many of these programs out there. You go buy gas and you're asked, do you have rewards? You go to a hardware store, you go to any type of ag country store, for example, to buy products for your farm. and they'll ask you, well, are you a rewards member? Well, yeah. Well, if so, then you can build up credit that will allow you to redeem those points. And once you get to a certain threshold, you might be able to buy an item from that retailer, or you can use them at a discount on a subsequent purchase. You might get a certain amount off per gallon of gas, for example. And sometimes they come in the mail to you and as a coupon, and you can redeem your reward points that way. Well, the question in Hyatt Hotels was whether the parent organization that has all of these associated hotels, and we can think of it also as an agribusiness that's got retail outlets, they create a fund in which the participating hotels, in this instance, contribute money, and they get reimbursed out of that fund when a customer redeems the reward points. Well, Hyatt Hotels, the parent corporation, is managing that fund, but they're not reporting the income in that fund. They're not reporting the income from the investments that they make based on the income in that fund. And they're not deducting any expenses when they pay amounts out of that fund to reimburse participating member hotels. And the IRS didn't like that, and the tax court agreed that they said, Hyatt, you maintain too much control over that fund. You're not able to claim that that is not included in income. It is. So that's a major, major case, and I think that has implications for a lot of retailers, including agribusiness retailers, that may not be doing this correctly from a tax standpoint.
So what do producers need to know about these rewards programs?
So it's a good case in terms of laying down a marker for those that are giving tax advice to clients that offer these customer loyalty reward programs. And the retail businesses that offer these and participate in these will want to ensure that their program is structured in a way that fits within this trust fund doctrine, the exception under that for excluding program funds from gross income. So I think it's a big case on the tax side of things.
And speaking of advice, Ethan Lane with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association says there's always room for improvement.
We are a grassroots organization, and that's where our strength comes from. And those leaders start as county leaders. They start in the states. You know, they start in those local conversations, and they build their credibility, they build their knowledge base on the policy side. And that results in them engaging in the national conversation within CBA, whether it's through a working group or a policy committee. You know, those vice chairmanships and chairmanships of those policy committees. So we just had those folks in town this week working on some planning for Orlando. You know, those people become the true thought leaders in the industry on those various issue sets, whether it's property rights or you know, federal lands or trade or tax and credit or, you know, animal health, you name it. And that's where that process starts. And that's really where you can get into the weeds and help shape where NCBA is headed in the next few years. And that really does start at home. I mean, that's where those ideas come from. And so, you know, not just our convention, but as we get around to those state conventions, that's always the most exciting part, is watching those conversations and seeing those next generation of leaders at work at their state level, you know, around the country.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
You know, as we work as an organization, and as even growers thinking about the future of all their crops, but let's focus on cotton.
Barry Worsham is president and CEO of Cotton Incorporated, says this really applies to all growers.
You've got to know what the market is going to want and what the environment is likely to be like. And I'm talking about the overall environment, of economic environment and political environment, and, you know, all of that. And we know, for example, that sustainability is going to continue to accelerate in terms of, or increase in terms of importance. Brands and retailers not only want things, quote, sustainable, whatever the specific definition may be, but they also want it verifiable. That's one change that has certainly happened over the last several years and will continue to increase in terms of its growth. The second that's more recent has been traceability, that brands and retailers want to know, have to know in some cases, where the product is coming from. And it's a challenge for cotton because, you know, most food crops are not blended. But if you want to know where your shirt, what the ingredients of your shirt, most cottons around the world are blended. So it could be U.S. cotton, it could be some Indian cotton in there, it could be some, you know, Brazilian cotton or even Chinese cotton. And the difficult thing for in the U.S. right now is the government is, with the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, is really cracking down on any kind of products coming into the U.S. in cotton that has any connection with the Western China or the Uyghur population. So that has made it imperative for brands and retailers to really know where the cotton is coming from. So you combine sustainability with traceability, and now they want to know what happens at the end of the life, which is, you know, does it, we don't want to throw stuff in the landfill. They want to know about biodegradation and does it create problems for water, and all of those things are just are important, and they're going to continue to be. So it's, on the one hand, it's kind of a challenge for the cotton industry to get all this lined up. But more importantly, I think is if we have an advantage finally over some synthetics. We can't compete with synthetics on price, but we can compete on sustainability and even circularity, because cotton is a natural fiber and it does biodegrade, and it, you know, creates its own seed, and there is a circularity to that. So that's what's coming, and I don't see any of those things going away anytime soon. And so that's both a challenge and an opportunity for growers.
And then you have to sell the product to consumers.
An agency is something you look at, you know, on a, I'd say, 10 years, 5 years, every once in a while, when they have turnover within the agency. But one of the things we were looking at is, with all the changes that are going on with television versus social media versus the multiple platforms, that we wanted to take a look to see if there's something out there that would be better for us to integrate all the ways that we try to connect with consumers. We do less with television than we used to, but we do way more, of course, in social media. So we interviewed, it took about 6 months, but I think I don't remember the starting point. I think it was like 40-some agencies bid on or we sent RFPs to 40-some agencies. 20-some of decided they were interested in our business. We culled that down and finally made the final choice in December this past year. And the agency is called Gale. And we expect there to be some, you know, new creatives and hopefully even better integration of our various ways that we try to reach the consumer and even brands and retailers. So that's an important, all these other things, sustainability and traceability are all important as well. But, you know, at the end of the day, you got to make sure you communicate with consumer about why they should care about cotton.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We're sounding the warning that this would be very costly to the world if we were to do it.
Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala is the Director General of the World Trade Organization.
You would really be signing a kind of sentence on emerging markets and developing countries who have for a long time been told that open markets, trading systems, no protectionism, that's the way to go. And just as they are getting into trying to integrate into world trade, and then, you know, you're turning your back on them. So that's why there's also a North-South divide that is emerging as southern countries begin to question what is happening with global trade. So the signs of fragmentation we're seeing, of course, that are emerging, you look at, even though you have these high numbers, if you go behind the numbers, you can see that in certain sectors, trade between China and the U.S. is already on the decline. Of course, in the technology sectors, in semiconductors, in certain areas. And so that is emerging. We also see in another simulation that trade between like-minded countries seems to be growing faster than between non-like-minded. If you simulate two blocks of like-minded and non-like-minded, just to simplify it. So those are some warning signs that we're beginning to see that we need to pay attention to. Now, you know, can I just say something? Does that mean that we shouldn't look at some of the vulnerability of supply chains that have emerged? We have to admit that during the pandemic, we saw vulnerability in supply chains. But what is the diagnosis? People blame trade and supply chains. But if you look at the issue, you see that the issue is really over-concentration of the production of certain products in certain geographies and in certain sectors. And that does not build resilience. So I do agree with those who say that let's look at certain sectors that are very important to the world and see how we deal with deconcentrating supply chains so that the world can be more resilient. That is the problem we really face. Semiconductors, 90% or more manufactured in one geography or one part of the world. Is that resilience? No. There's some argument that we should look at that. Pharmaceuticals, you saw during the pandemic how, let's say, a continent like Africa imports 99% of vaccines and 90% of pharmaceuticals. Should that be that we're at the back of the queue when all this happened? No. Maybe we need to deconcentrate some of these pharmaceutical supply chains. So I think there's an argument for building resilience. This is why I'll end on this note on this. We are arguing for a new reimagining of globalization. So we are not saying that people who have problems are completely wrong. There are issues to look at. Let's reimagine globalization to deconcentrate some of these supply chains, to build more resilience by looking at how we relocate the supply chains, by putting them in countries and in regions of rich countries that were at the margins of the global supply chains before. By the way, there, you know, 50 million jobs turnover in the U.S. each year. Yeah. The Peterson Institute work has also shown that only 0.6% of this is attributable to trade.
Yeah.
The technology is in play, but of course it's easy to blame trade. Nevertheless, we're arguing if you want to relocate supply chains, look at those regions where people have been left behind. We're not against that, because this will help us build a new kind of globalization.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
As we look at forage supply this year, I think in general we're probably in better shape than we were a year ago.
Dr. Mike Brook is a longtime Kansas State Extension dairy specialist. Talking about forage supplies here in 2024.
A year ago, we had major drought here in the western part of our state as well as the state south of us. So at this time last year, we were moving a lot of forage, particularly grass, haze, and straw, actually out of Kansas into the southwest part of the United States. Today, that's not the same. We don't have that strong demand that we had a year ago. However, our supply of things like prairie hay and grass hay tend to be a little bit limited here in Kansas. We do have some supply available. It's probably higher price than what you would like to pay, but it is available. So for our dairy herds, what do we need to be thinking about in terms of assuring that we have enough forage to make it through the winter and the spring? Well, first off, doing a good job on inventory and understanding exactly what you have on hand in terms of silages and dried forage is very, very important. Secondly, I think you're going to have to probably look at how you minimize the use of certain forages in feeding your dairy herd. So some of the things you're going to need to consider is how can we substitute in some crop residues, corn stalks, maybe milo stalks, maybe some sorghum silage or sorghum hay that we have harvested. How do we substitute that in for some of the grass hays that we typically use in our dairy diets? We may not want to totally replace them, but we may need to replace part of those forages so that we can have enough to stretch through the total feeding season. So you need to work very closely with your nutritionist, you know, and there are some nuances to doing some of this. For example, corn stalks can be an excellent partial forage replacement for things like dry cows. However, when you try to feed corn stalks to heifers, consumption is probably going to be a bit of a challenge. Maybe you can grind them fairly fine and get some consumption out of those types of forages with heifers. But again, it's probably going to be fairly limited to what we might be able to do with dry cows. As you look at your lactating cows, alfalfa hay continues to be available, maybe a bit pricey, but it is available. If you're trying to conserve on costs there, you might want to work with your nutritionist to look at how we might substitute in just a little bit of straw, maybe only a pound or 2 pounds of straw per animal per day, to reduce the amount of alfalfa hay that we're actually using in the diet, keeping in mind that straw that we add to the diet is really just for roughage. It doesn't really add a lot nutritionally to the diet. So we're going to have to feed a little bit of extra protein, a little bit of extra energy to make up for the differences in protein and energy between straw and something like alfalfa hay. I would also encourage you, if you're short of forages, you really need to start identify where you are going to purchase those to make it through the feeding season. And I would suggest that you do that fairly soon. waiting could result in cost savings, but there's no guarantee of supply as we get later into the feeding season. So assuring that you have enough supply available for your herd, including replacements, is critically important as we move into the winter months.
K-State Dairy Specialist Mike Brook. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We should think when we are deconcentrating supply chains to locate them in such a fashion that if something happens, a climatic event, we are less affected in the world than we would have been if we again just concentrated things in certain countries because they are friends.
Director General, World Trade Organization, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, on friend shoring.
So that is why I love Vietnam and Indonesia and India, and I want them all to develop. So make no mistake. But I'm saying that if businesses fall into this China plus one strategy again, we'll have another set of concentrations. And that may not be wise for the world. You know, so let us look, they are friends. Europe is also a friend, but can we spread these supply chains in a way that makes more sense for resilience?